Time floods over the natural dams of survival and self-interest. We witnessed it in the summer of 1964, when white college students risked their lives to carry the torch of human freedom into darkest Mississippi. An earlier instance, George Orwell describes his self-interest in entering the trenches during the Spanish Civil War as a matter of trying to stop the spreading horror of fascism. Yet once he was in the trenches, his self-interest changed to the goal of getting out alive. Still, I have no question that, if Orwell had been given a military assignment from which he could easily have got lost, he would not have wandered to the rear at the price of jeopardizing the lives of some of his comrades. He would never have pursued his self-interest. These are the exceptions to the rule, but there have been enough of them flashing through the murky past of history to suggest that these episodic transfigurations of the human spirit are more than the flash of fireflies. Compromise. Compromise is another word that carries shades of weakness, vacillation, betrayal of ideals, surrender of moral principles. In the old culture, when virginity was a virtue, one referred to a woman's being compromised. The word is generally regarded as ethically unsavory and ugly. But to the organizer, compromise is a key and beautiful word. It is always present in the pragmatics of operation. It is making the deal, getting that vital breather, usually the victory. If you start with nothing, demand 100%, then compromise for 30%, you're 30% ahead. A free and open society is an ongoing conflict, interrupted periodically by compromises which then become the start for the continuation of conflict, compromise, and on ad infinitum. Control of power is based on compromise in our Congress, and among the executive, legislative, and judicial branches. A society devoid of compromise is totalitarian. If I had to define a free and open society in one word, the word would be compromise. Ego. All definitions of words, like everything else, are relative. Definition is to a major degree dependent upon your partisan position. Your leader is always flexible, he has pride in the dignity of his cause, he is unflinching, sincere, an ingenious tactician fighting the good fight. To the opposition he is unprincipled, and will go whichever way the wind blows, his arrogance is masked by a fake humility, he is dogmatically stubborn, a hypocrite, unscrupulous and unethical, and he will do anything to win, he is leading the forces of evil. To one side he is a demigod, to the other a demagogue. Nowhere is the relativity of a definition more germane in the arena of life than the word ego. Anyone who is working against the haves is always facing odds, and in many cases heavy odds. If he or she does not have that complete self-confidence, or call it ego, that he can win, then the battle is lost, before it has even begun. I have seen so-called trained organizers go out to another city with an assignment of organizing a community of approximately 100,000 people, take one look and promptly wire in a resignation. To be able to look at a community of people, and say to yourself, I will organize them in so many weeks, I will take on the corporations, the press and anything else, is to be a real organizer. Ego, as we understand and use it here, cannot be even vaguely confused with, nor is it remotely related to, egotism. No would-be organizer afflicted with egotism can avoid hiding this from the people with whom he is working, no contrived humility can conceal it. Nothing antagonizes people, and alienates them from a would-be organizer more than the revealing flashes of arrogance, vanity, impatience, and contempt of a personal egotism. The ego of the organizer is stronger and more monumental than the ego of the leader. The leader is driven by the desire for power, while the organizer is driven by the desire to create. The organizer is in a true sense reaching for the highest level for which man can reach to create, to be a great creator, to play God. An infection of egotism would make it impossible to respect the dignity of individuals, to understand people, or to strive to develop the other element that make up the ideal organizer. Egotism is mainly a defensive reaction of feelings of personal inadequacy. Ego is a positive conviction and belief in one's ability, with no need for egotistical behavior. Ego moves on every level. How can an organizer respect the dignity of an individual, if he does not respect his own dignity? How can he believe in people, if he does not really believe in himself? How can he convince people, that they have it within themselves, that they have the power, to stand up to win if he does not believe it of himself. Ego must be so all-pervading that the personality of the organizer is contagious, that it converts the people from despair to defiance, creating a mass ego. Conflict. Conflict is another bad word in the general opinion. This is a consequence of two influences in our society. One influence is organized religion, which has espoused a rhetoric of turning the other cheek, and has quoted the scriptures as the devil never would have dared, because of their major previous function of supporting the establishment. The second influence is probably the most subversive and insidious one, and it has permeated the American scene in the last generation, that is Madison Avenue public relations, middle-class moral hygiene, which has made of conflict or controversy something negative and undesirable. This has all been part of an advertising culture that emphasizes getting along with people and avoiding friction. If you look at our television commercials, you get the picture that American society is largely devoted to ensuring that no odors come from our mouths or armpits. Consensus is a keynote. One must not offend one's fellow man, and so today we find that people in the mass media are fired for expressing their opinions or being controversial. In the churches they are fired for the same reason, but the words used there are lacking in prudence, and on university campuses, faculty members are fired for the same reason, but the words used there are personality difficulties. Conflict is the essential core of a free and open society. If one were to project the democratic way of life in the form of musical score, its major theme would be the harmony of dissonance. The education of an organizer. The building of many mass power organizations to merge into a national popular power force cannot come without many organizers. Since organizations are created, in large part, by the organizer, we must find out what creates the organizer. This has been the major problem of my years of organizational experience, the finding of potential organizers and their training. For the past 2 years I have had a special training school for organizers with a full-time, 15-month program. Its students have ranged from middle-class women activists to Catholic priests and Protestant ministers of all denominations. From militant Indians to Chicanos to Puerto Ricans to blacks from all parts of the black power spectrum, from Panthers to radical philosophers, from a variety of campus activists, SDS and others, to a priest who was joining a revolutionary party in South America. Geographically they have come from campuses and Jesuit seminaries in Boston to Chicanos from tiny Texas towns, middle-class people from Chicago and Hartford and Seattle, and almost every place in between. An increasing number of students come from Canada, from the Indians of the Northwest to the middle class of the Maritime Provinces. 4 years before the formal school was begun, I spent most of my time on the education as an organizer of every member of my staff. The education of an organizer requires frequent long conferences on organizational problems, analysis of power patterns, communication, conflict tactics, the education and development of community leaders, and the methods of introduction of new issues. In these discussions, we have found ourselves dealing with quite a range of issues, internal problems of a clique in a Los Angeles organization out to get rid of its organizer, a Christmas tree selling fundraising fiasco in San Jose, and why it failed, a massive voter registration drive in a Chicago project, which was being delayed in getting started, a group in Rochester, New York, attacking the organizer, so that they could get their hot hands on the funds earmarked for organization and so on. Always the potential organizer's personal experience was used as a basis for teaching. Always after the problem was solved there would be long sessions in which a post-mortem would dissect the specifics, and then stitch them into a synthesis, a body of concepts. All experiences are significant only insofar as they are related to, and illuminating a central concept. History does not repeat specific situations. If any of the examples in these pages are read isolated from the general concept, they will be nothing more than a series of anecdotes. Everything became a learning experience. Frequently personal domestic hang-ups were part of the conferences. An organizer's working schedule is so continuous that time is meaningless. Meetings and caucuses drag endlessly into the early morning hours. Any schedule is marked by constant unexpected unscheduled meetings. Work pursues an organizer into his or her home, so that either he is on the phone or there are people dropping in. The marriage record of organizers is with rare exception disastrous. Further, the tensions, the hours, the home situation, and the opportunities do not argue for fidelity. Also, with rare exception, I have not known really competent organizers who were concerned about celibacy. Here and there are wives and husbands or those in love relationships who understand and are committed to the work and are real sources of strength to the organizer. Besides the full-timers, there were the community leaders whom we trained on the job to be organizers. Organizers are not only essential to start and build an organization, they are also essential to keep it going. Maintaining interest and activity, keeping the group's goals strong and flexible at once, is a different operation but still organization. As I look back on the results of those years, they seem to be a potpourri, with, I would judge, more failures than successes. Here and there are organizers who are outstanding in their chosen fields, and are featured by the press as my trained protégés, but to me the overall record has been unpromising. Those out of their local communities, who were trained on the job achieved certain levels, and were at the end of their line. If one thinks of an organizer as a highly imaginative and creative architect and engineer, then the best we have been able to train on the job were skilled plumbers, electricians, and carpenters, all essential to the building and maintenance of their community structure, but incapable of going elsewhere to design and execute a new structure in a new community. Then there were others who learned to be outstanding organizers in particular kinds of communities with particular ethnic groups, but in a different scene with different ethnic groups couldn't organize their way out of a paper bag. Then there were those rare campus activists who could organize a substantial number of students, but they were utter failures when it came to trying to communicate with and organize lower middle class workers. Labor union organizers turned out to be poor community organizers. Their experience was tied to a pattern of fixed points, whether it was definite demands on wages, pensions, vacation periods, or other working conditions, and all of this was anchored into particular contract dates. Once the issues were settled, and a contract signed, the years before the next contract negotiation held only grievance meetings about charges on contract violations by either side. Mass organization is a different animal, it is not housebroken. There are no fixed chronological points or definite issues. The demands are always changing, the situation is fluid and ever-shifting, and many of the goals are not in concrete terms of dollars and hours, but are psychological and constantly changing, like such stuff as dreams are made on. I have seen labor organizers almost out of their minds from the community organization scene. When labor leaders have talked about organizing the poor, their talk has been based on nostalgia, a wistful look back to the labor organizers of the CIO through the Great Depression of the 30s. Those labor organizers, Powers Hapgood, Henry Johnson, and Lee Pressman, for instance, were primarily middle-class revolutionary activists to whom the CIO labor organizing drive was just one of many activities. The agendas of those labor union mass meetings were 10% on the specific problems of that union and 90% speakers on the conditions and needs of the Southern Okies, the Spanish Civil War and the International Brigade, raising funds for blacks who were on trial in some southern state, demanding high relief for the unemployed, denouncing police brutality, raising funds for anti-Nazi organizations, demanding an end to American sales of scrap iron to the Japanese military complex, and on. They were radicals, and they were good at their job. They organized vast sectors of middle-class America in support of their programs. But they are gone, now, and any resemblance between them and the present professional labor organizer is only in title. Among the organizers I trained and failed with, there were some who memorized the words and the related experiences and concepts. Listening to them was like listening to a tape playing back my presentation word for word. Clearly there was little understanding, clearly, they could not do more than elementary organization. The problem with so many of them was and is their failure to understand that a statement of a specific situation is significant only in its relationship to and its illumination of a general concept. Instead they see the specific action as a terminal point. They find it difficult to grasp the fact that no situation ever repeats itself, that no tactic can be precisely the same. Then there were those who had trained in schools of social work to become community organizers. Community Organization 101, 102, and 103. They had done field work, and acquired even a specialized vocabulary. They call it CO, which to us means conscientious objector, or community org, which to us evokes a huge Freudian fantasy. Basically, the difference between their goals and ours is that they organize to get rid of full-egged rats and stop there. We organize to get rid of full-egged rats, so we can get on to removing two-legged rats. Among those who, disillusioned, reject the formalized garbage they learned in school, the odds are heavily against their developing into effective organizers. One reason is that despite their verbal denunciations of their past training, there is a strong subconscious block against repudiating 2 to 3 years of life spent in this training, as well as the financial cost of these courses. Through these years, I have constantly tried to search out reasons for our failures as well as our occasional successes in training organizers. Our teaching methods, those of others, our personal competency for teaching, and improvised new teaching approaches, have and are being examined. Our own self-criticism is far more rigorous than that of our most bitter critics. All of us have faults. I know that in a community, working as an organizer, I have unlimited patience in talking to, and listening to the local residents. Any organizer must have this patience. But among my faults, is that in a teaching position at the training institute, or at conferences, I become an intellectual snob with unimaginative, limited students, impatient, bored, and inexcusably rude. I have improvised teaching approaches. For example, knowing that one can only communicate and understand in terms of one's experience, we had to construct experience for our students. Most people do not accumulate a body of experience. Most people go through life undergoing a series of happenings, which pass through their systems undigested. Happenings become experiences when they are digested, when they are reflected on, related to general patterns, and synthesized. There is meaning to that cliche, we learn from experience. Our job was to shovel those happenings back into the student's system, so he could digest them into experience. During a seminar, I would say, life is the expectation of the unexpected. The things you worry about rarely happen. Something new, the unexpected, will usually come in from outside the ballpark. You're all nodding as if you understand, but you really don't. What I've said are just words to you. I want you to go to your private cubbyholes and think for the next 4 hours. Try to remember all the things you worried about during the last years, and whether they ever happened or what did happen, and then we'll talk about it. At the next session, the student reactions were excited. Hey, you're right. Only one out of the 8 big worries I've had ever happened, and even that one was different from the way I worried about it. I understand what you mean. And he did. While the experience of trying to educate organizers has been nowhere so successful as I'd hoped, there was a great deal of education for me and my associates. We were constantly in a state of self-examination. First, we learned what the qualities of an ideal organizer are, and second, we were confronted with a basic question, whether it was possible to teach or educate for the achieving of these qualities. The area of experience and communication is fundamental to the organizer. An organizer can communicate only within the areas of experience of his audience, otherwise there is no communication. The organizer, in his constant hunt for patterns, universalities, and meaning, is always building up a body of experience. Through his imagination, he is constantly moving in on the happenings of others, identifying with them, and extracting their happenings into his own mental digestive system and thereby accumulating more experience. It is essential for communication that he know of their experiences. Since one can communicate only through the experiences of the other, it becomes clear that the organizer begins to develop an abnormally large body of experience. He learns the local legends, anecdotes, values, idioms. He listens to small talk. He refrains from rhetoric foreign to the local culture. He knows that worn-out words like white racist, fascist pig, and motherfucker have been so spewed about that using them is now within the negative experience of the local people, serving only to identify the speaker as one of those nuts, and to turn off any further communication. And yet the organizer must not try to fake it. He must be himself. I remember a first meeting with Mexican-American leaders in a California barrio where they served me a special Mexican dinner. When we were halfway through, I put down my knife and fork saying, "My God. Do you eat this stuff because you like it or because you have to? I think it's as lousy as the Jewish kosher crap I had to eat as a kid." There was a moment of shocked silence, and then everybody roared. Suddenly barriers began to come down as they all began talking and laughing. They were so accustomed to the Anglo who would rave about the beauty of Mexican food, even though they knew it was killing him, the Anglo who had memorized a few Spanish phrases with the inevitable hasta la vista, that it was a refreshingly honest experience to them. The incident became a legend to many, and you would hear them say, for instance, "He has as much use for that guy as Alinsky has for Mexican food." A number of the Mexican Americans present confessed that they only ate some of those dishes when they entertained an Anglo. The same faking goes on with whites on certain items of black soul food. There is a difference between honesty and rude disrespect of another's tradition. The organizer will err far less by being himself than by engaging in professional techniques when the people really know better. It shows respect for people to be honest, as in the Mexican dinner episode, they are being treated as people, and not guinea pigs being techniqued. It is most important that this action be understood in context. Prior to my remark, there had been a warm personal discussion of the problems of the people. They knew not only of my concern about their plight, but that I liked them as people. I felt their response in friendship, and we were together. It is in this totality of the situation that I did what, otherwise, would have been offensive. The qualities we were trying to develop in organizers in the years of attempting to train them included some qualities that in all probability cannot be taught. They either had them, or could get them only through a miracle from above or below. Other qualities they might have as potentials that could be developed. Sometimes the development of one quality triggered off unsuspected others. I learned to check against the list and spot the negatives, and if it was impossible to develop that quality, at least I could be aware and on guard to try to diminish its negative effect upon the work. Here is the list of the ideal element of an organizer, the items one looks for in identifying potential organizers, and in appraising the future possibilities of new organizers, and the pivot points of any kind of educational curricula for organizers. Certainly it is an idealized list. I doubt that such qualities, in such intensity, ever come together in one man or woman, yet the best of organizers should have them all, to a strong extent, and any organizer needs at least a degree of each. Curiosity. What makes an organizer organize? He is driven by a compulsive curiosity that knows no limits. Warning clichés such as curiosity killed a cat are meaningless to him. For life is for him a search for a pattern, for similarities in seeming differences in seeming similarities, for an order in the chaos about us, for a meaning to the life around him, and its relationship to his own life, and the search never ends. He goes forth with the question as his mark, and suspects that there are no answers, only further questions. The organizer becomes a carrier of the contagion of curiosity, for a people asking why are beginning to rebel. The questioning of the hitherto accepted ways and values is a reformation stage that precedes, and is so essential to the revolution. Here, I couldn't disagree more with Freud. In a letter to Mary Bonaparte, he said, "The moment a man questions the meaning and value of life, he is sick." If there is, somewhere, an answer about life, I suspect that the key to it is finding the core question. Actually, Socrates was an organizer. The function of an organizer is to raise questions that agitate, that break through the accepted pattern. Socrates, with his goal of know thyself, was raising the internal questions within the individual that are so essential for the revolution which is external to the individual. So Socrates was carrying out the first stage of making revolutionaries. If he had been permitted to continue raising questions about the meaning of life, to examine life, and refuse the conventional values, the internal revolution would soon have moved out into the political arena. Those who tried him, and sentenced him to death, knew what they were doing. Irreverence. Curiosity and irreverence go together. Curiosity cannot exist without the other. Curiosity asks, "Is this true? Just because this has always been the way, is this the best or right way of life, the best or right religion, political or economic value, morality?" to the questioner nothing is sacred. He detests dogma, defies any finite definition of morality, rebels against any repression of a free open search for ideas, no matter where they may lead. He is challenging, insulting, agitating, discrediting. He stirs unrest. As with all life, this is a paradox, for his irreverence is rooted in a deep reverence for the enigma of life, and an incessant search for its meaning. It could be argued that reverence for others, for their freedom from injustice, poverty, ignorance, exploitation, discrimination, disease, war, hate, and fear, is not a necessary quality in a successful organizer. All I can say, is that such reverence is a quality I would have to see in anyone I would undertake to teach. Imagination. Imagination is the inevitable partner of irreverence and curiosity. How can one be curious without being imaginative? According to Webster's Unabridged, imagination is the mental synthesis of new ideas from element experienced separately. The broader meaning starts with the notion of mental imaging of things suggested, but not previously experienced, and thence expands to the idea of mental creation and poetic idealization, creative imagination. To the organizer, imagination is not only all this but something deeper. It is the dynamism that starts and sustains him in his whole life of action as an organizer. It ignites and feeds the force that drives him to organize for change. There was a time when I believed that the basic quality that an organizer needed was a deep sense of anger against injustice, and that this was the prime motivation that kept him going. I now know that it is something else, this abnormal imagination, that sweeps him into a close identification with mankind and projects him into its plight. He suffers with them, and becomes angry at the injustice, and begins to organize the rebellion. Clarence Darrow put it on more of a self-interest basis: I had a vivid imagination. Not only could I put myself in the other person's place, but I could not avoid doing so. My sympathies always went out to the weak, the suffering, and the poor. Realizing their sorrows, I tried to relieve them in order that I myself might be relieved. Imagination is not only the fuel for the force that keeps organizers organizing, it is also the basis for effective tactics and action. The organizer knows that the real action is in the reaction of the opposition. To realistically appraise and anticipate the probable reactions of the enemy, he must be able to identify with them too, in his imagination, and foresee their reactions to his actions. A sense of humor. Back to Webster's Unabridged, humor is defined as the mental faculty of discovering, expressing, or appreciating ludicrous or absurdly incongruous element in ideas, situations, happenings, or acts, or a changing and uncertain state of mind. The organizer, searching with a free and open mind void of certainty, hating dogma, finds laughter not just a way to maintain his sanity, but also a key to understanding life. Essentially, life is a tragedy, and the converse of tragedy is comedy. One can change a few lines in any Greek tragedy, and it becomes a comedy, and vice versa. Knowing that contradictions are the signposts of progress, he is ever on the alert for contradictions. A sense of humor helps him identify and make sense out of them. Humor is essential to a successful tactician, for the most potent weapons known to mankind are satire and ridicule. A sense of humor enables him to maintain his perspective, and see himself for what he really is, a bit of dust that burns for a fleeting second. A sense of humor is incompatible with the complete acceptance of any dogma, any religious, political, or economic prescription for salvation. It synthesizes with curiosity, irreverence, and imagination. The organizer has a personal identity of his own that cannot be lost by absorption or acceptance of any kind of group discipline or organization. I now begin to understand what I stated somewhat intuitively in Reveille for Radicals almost 20 years ago, that the organizer, in order to be part of all, can be part of none. A bit of a blurred vision of a better world. Much of an organizer's daily work is detail, repetitive and deadly in its monotony. In the totality of things, he is engaged in one small bit. It is as though, as an artist, he is painting a tiny leaf. It is inevitable that sooner or later he will react with, "What am I doing spending my whole life just painting one little leaf? The hell with it, I quit." What keeps him going is a blurred vision of a great mural where other artists' organizers are painting their bits, and each piece is essential to the total. An organized personality. The organizer must be well organized himself, so he can be comfortable in a disorganized situation, rational in a sea of irrationalities. It is vital that he be able to accept and work with the rationalities for the purpose of change. With very rare exceptions, the right things are done for the wrong reasons. It is futile to demand that men do the right thing for the right reason. This is a fight with a windmill. The organizer should know and accept that the right reason is only introduced as a moral rationalization after the right end has been achieved, although it may have been achieved for the wrong reason. Therefore, he should search for and use the wrong reasons to achieve the right goals. He should be able, with skill and calculation, to use irrationality in his attempts to progress toward a rational world. For a variety of reasons, the organizer must develop multiple issues. First, a wide-based membership can only be built on many issues. When we were building our organization in the back of the yards, the Polish Roman Catholic churches in Chicago joined us because they were concerned about the expanding power of the Irish Roman Catholic churches. The Parking House Workers Union was with us, so their rival unions joined, trying to counteract the potential membership and power pickup. We didn't, of course, care why they'd joined us. We just knew we'd be better off if they did. The organizer recognizes that each person or block bears a hierarchy of values. For instance, let us assume that we are in a ghetto community where everyone is for civil rights. A black man there had bought a small house when the neighborhood was first changing, and he wound up paying a highly inflated price, more than 4 times the value of the property. Everything he owns is tied into that house. Urban renewal, now, is threatening to come in and take it on the basis of a value appraisal according to their criteria, which would be less than a fourth of his financial commitment. He is desperately trying to save his own small economic world. Civil rights would get him to a meeting once a month, maybe he'd sign some petitions and maybe he'd give a dollar here and there, but on a fight against urban renewal's threat to wipe out his property, he would come to meetings every night. Next door to him is a woman who is renting. She is not concerned about urban renewal. She has 3 small girls, and her major worry is the drug pushers and pimps that infest the neighborhood and threaten the future of her children. She is for civil rights too, but she is more concerned about a community free of pimps and pushers, and she wants better schools for her children. Those are her number one priorities. Next door to her is a family on welfare. Their number one priority is more money. Across the street there is a family who can be described as the working poor, struggling to get along on their drastically limited budget. To them, consumer prices and local merchants gouging are the number one priorities. Any tenant of a slum landlord, living among rats and cockroaches, will quickly tell you what his number one priority is, and so it goes. In a multiple issue organization, each person is saying to the other, "I can't get what I want alone and neither can you. Let's make a deal. 111 support you for what you want, and you support me for what I want." Those deals become the program. Not only does a single or even a dual issue organization condemn you to a small organization, it is axiomatic that a single issue organization won't last. An organization needs action as an individual needs oxygen. With only 1 or 2 issues, there will certainly be a lapse of action, and then comes death. Multiple issues mean constant action and life. An organizer must become sensitive to everything that is happening around him. He is always learning, and every incident teaches him something. He notices that when a bus has only a few empty seats, the crowd trying to get on will push and shove. If there are many empty seats, the crowd will be courteous and considerate, and he muses that in a world of opportunities for all, there would be a change in human behavior for the good. In his constant examination of life and of himself, he finds himself becoming more and more of an organized personality. A well-integrated political schizoid. The organizer must become schizoid politically in order not to slip into becoming a true believer. Before men can act, an issue must be polarized. Men will act when they are convinced that their cause is 100% on the side of the angels, and that the opposition are 100% on the side of the devil. He knows that there can be no action until issues are polarized to this degree. I have already discussed an example in the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Particulars, that conspicuously omitted all the advantages the colonies had gained from the British, and cited only the disadvantages. What I'm saying is that the organizer must be able to split himself into two parts, one part in the arena of action, where he polarizes the issue to 100 to nothing, and helps to lead his forces into conflict, while the other part knows that when the time comes for negotiations that it really is only a 10% difference, and yet both parts have to live comfortably with each other. Only a well-organized person can split and yet stay together. But this is what the organizer must do. Ego. Throughout these desired qualities is interwoven a strong ego, one we might describe as monumental in terms of solidity. Here we are using the word ego as discussed in the previous chapter, clearly differentiated from egotism. Ego is unreserved confidence in one's ability to do what he believes must be done. An organizer must accept, without fear or worry, that the odds are always against him. Having this kind of ego, he is a doer and does. The thought of copping out never stays with him for more than a fleeting moment. Life is action. A free and open mind, and political relativity. The organizer in his way of life, with his curiosity, irreverence, imagination, sense of humor, distrust of dogma, his self-organization, his understanding of the irrationality of much of human behavior, becomes a flexible personality, not a rigid structure that breaks when something unexpected happens. Having his own identity, he has no need for the security of an ideology or a panacea. He knows that life is a quest for uncertainty, that the only certain fact of life is uncertainty, and he can live with it. He knows that all values are relative, in a world of political relativity. Because of these qualities, he is unlikely to disintegrate into cynicism and disillusionment, for he does not depend on illusion. Finally, the organizer is constantly creating the new out of the old. He knows that all new ideas arise from conflict, that every time man has had a new idea it has been a challenge to the sacred ideas of the past and the present, and inevitably a conflict has raged. Curiosity, irreverence, imagination, sense of humor, a free and open mind, an acceptance of the relativity of values, and of the uncertainty of life, all inevitably fuse into the kind of person whose greatest joy is creation. He conceives of creation as the very essence of the meaning of life. In his constant striving for the new, he finds that he cannot endure what is repetitive and unchanging. For him, hell would be doing the same thing over and over again. This is the basic difference between the leader and the organizer. The leader goes on to build power to fulfill his desires, to hold and wield the power for purposes both social and personal. He wants power himself. The organizer finds his goal in creation of power for others to use. These qualities are present in any free creative person, whether an educator, or in the arts, or in any part of life. In Adam Smith's The Money Game, the characteristics of the desirable fund manager are described. It is personal intuition, sensing patterns of behavior. There is always something unknown, undiscerned. You can't just graduate an analyst into managing funds. What is it the good managers have? It is a kind of locked-in concentration, an intuition, a feel, nothing that can be schooled. The first thing you have to know is yourself. A man who knows himself can step outside himself and watch his own reactions like an observer. One would think that this was a description of an organizer, but in everything creative, whether it is organizing a mutual fund or a mutual society, one is on the hunt for these qualities. Why one becomes an organizer instead of something else is, I suspect, due to a difference of degree of intensity of specific element or relationships between them or accident. Communication. One can lack any of the qualities of an organizer with one exception and still be effective and successful. That exception is the art of communication. It does not matter what you know about anything, if you cannot communicate to your people. In that event you are not even a failure. You're just not there. Communication with others takes place when they understand what you're trying to get across to them. If they don't understand, then you are not communicating regardless of words, pictures, or anything else. People only understand things in terms of their experience, which means that you must get within their experience. Further, communication is a two-way process. If you try to get your ideas across to others without paying attention to what they have to say to you, you can forget about the whole thing. I know that I have communicated with the other party when his eyes light up and he responds, "I know exactly what you mean." I had something just like that happen to me once. Let me tell you about ITL, then I know that there has been communication. Recently I flew from O'Hare Airport in Chicago to New York. After the jet pulled away from the gate, we heard the familiar announcement, "This is your captain speaking. I'm sorry to advise you that we are number 18 for takeoff. I'm turning off the no smoking sign and will keep you posted." Many a captain feels compelled to keep you entertained with an incessant stream of verbal garbage. "You will be interested to know that this airplane fully loaded weighs blah blah tons. You couldn't care less." Or, "Our flight plan will carry us over Bazicus, Ohio, and then Junk Spot, etc., etc." However, on this trip the captain of the plane touched on the experience of many of the passengers and really communicated. In the midst of his entertainment he commented, "Incidentally, I will let you know when we get the takeoff clearance, and from the instant you hear those jets roar for the takeoff until the instant of liftoff, we will have consumed enough fuel for you to drive an automobile from Chicago to New York, and back with detours as well." You could hear such comments as, "Oh, come on, he must be kidding." With the announcement of clearance and the takeoff run, passengers all over the plane were looking at their watches. At the end of approximately 25 seconds to liftoff, passengers were turning to each other saying, "Would you believe it?" It was evident that, as you might expect, many passengers had been concerned at some time with the number of miles a car could travel on a given amount of gas. Educators are in common agreement on this concept of communication, even though few teachers use it. But after all, there are only a few real teachers in that profession. An educational leader makes this point of understanding and experience in a very personal way. When he has had experience of life. Read Homer and Horace by all means, says Newman, feed mind and eye and ear with their images and language and music, but do not expect to understand what they are really talking about before you are 40. This truth was first brought home to me more than 30 years ago one December day, as I walked down the road from Argentiers to Chamonix after a snowfall, and suddenly from the abyss of unconscious memory a line of Virgil rose into my mind, and I found myself repeating "sed ius et agerimus navis informis et alto terra gelu." I had read the words at school, and no doubt translated them glibly, "The earth lies formless under snow drifts and deep frost," but suddenly, with the snow seen before my eyes, I perceived for the first time what Virgil meant by the epithet informis, without form, and how perfectly it describes the work of snow, which literally does make the world formless, blurring the sharp outlines of roofs and eaves, of pines and rocks and mountain ridges, taking from them their definiteness of shape and form. Yet how many times before that day had I read the words without seeing what they really mean? It is not that the word informis meant nothing to me when I was an undergraduate, but it meant much less than its full meaning. Personal experience was necessary to real understanding. Sir Richard Livingstone, On Education, New York, 1945, p. 13. Every now and then I have been accused of being crude and vulgar, because I have used analogies of sex or the toilet. I do not do this, because I want to shock, particularly, but because there are certain experiences common to all, and sex and toilet are two of them. Furthermore, everyone is interested in those two, which can't be said of every common experience. I remember explaining relativity in morals, by telling the following story. A question is put to three women, one American, one British, and one French: what would they do if they found themselves shipwrecked on a desert island with six sex-hungry men? The American woman said she would try to hide and build a raft at night, or send up smoke signals in order to escape. The British woman said she would pick the strongest man and shack up with him so that he could protect her from the others. The French woman looked up quizzically and asked, "What's the problem?" Since people understand only in terms of their own experience, an organizer must have at least a cursory familiarity with their experience, It not only serves communication, but it strengthens the personal identification of the organizer with the others, and facilitates further communication. For example, in one community there was a Greek Orthodox priest, who will be called here the Archimandrite Anastopoulos. Every Saturday night, faithfully followed by six of his church members, he would tour the local taverns. After some hours of imbibing, he would suddenly stiffen, and become so drunk, that he was paralyzed. At this point his faithful six, like pallbearers, would carry him through the streets back to the safety of his church. Over the years it became part of the community's experience, in fact a living legend. In talking to anyone in that neighborhood you could not communicate the fact that something was out of place, not with it, except to say it was out like the Archimandrite. The response would be laughter, nodding of heads, yeah, we know what you mean, but also an intimacy of sharing a common experience. When you are trying to communicate, and can't find the point in the experience of the other party at which he can receive and understand, then, you must create the experience for him. I was trying to explain to two staff organizers, in training, how their problems in their community, arose because they had gone outside the experience of their people, that when you go outside anyone's experience not only do you not communicate, you cause confusion. They had earnest, intelligent expressions on their faces, and were verbally and visually agreeing and understanding, but I knew they really didn't understand, and that I was not communicating. I had not got into their experience. So I had to give them an experience. We were having lunch in a restaurant at the time. I called their attention to the luncheon menu listing 8 items or combinations and all numbered. Item number 1 was bacon and eggs, potatoes, toast, and coffee, item number 2, something else, and item number 6 was a chicken liver omelette. I explained that the waiter was conditioned in terms of his experience, to immediately translate any order into its accompanying number. He would listen to the words bacon and eggs, etc., but his mind had already clicked no one. The only variation was, whether the eggs were to be done easy, or the bacon very crisp, in which case he would call out, no one, easy, or a variation thereof. With this clear, I said, now, when the waiter takes my order, instead of my saying a chicken liver omelette, which to him is number 6, I will go outside his area of experience, and say, you see this chicken liver omelette? He will respond, yes, number 6. I will say, well, just a minute. I don't want the chicken livers in the omelette. I want the omelette with the chicken livers on the side now, is that clear? He will say it is, and then the odds are 9-1 everything is going to get screwed up, because he can't just order number 6 anymore. I don't know what will happen, but I have gone outside his accepted area of experience. The waiter took my order precisely as I have described above. In about 20 minutes he returned with an omelette and a full order of chicken livers, as well as a bill for $3.25 to $1.75 for the omelette, and $1.50 for the chicken livers. I objected and immediately took issue, pointing out that all I had wanted was number 6, the total price of which was $1.50, but that instead of having the livers mixed in with the omelette, I had wanted them on the side. Now there was a full omelette, a full order of chicken livers, and a bill for nearly 3 times the menu price. Furthermore, I could not eat a full order of chicken livers as well as the omelette. Confusion came down. Waiter and manager huddled. Finally the waiter returned, flushed and upset, sorry about the mistake, everybody got mixed up, eat whatever you want. The bill was changed back to the original price for number 6. In a similar situation in Los Angeles, 4 staff members and I were talking in front of the Biltmore Hotel, when I demonstrated the same point, saying, look, I'm holding a $10 bill in my hand. I propose to walk around the Biltmore Hotel, a total of 4 blocks, and try to give it away. This will certainly be outside of everyone's experience. You 4 walk behind me, and watch the faces of the people I'll approach. I'm going to go up to them holding out this $10 bill and say, here, take this. My guess is, that everyone will back off, look confused, insulted, or fearful, and want to get away from this nut fast. From their experience, when someone approaches them, he is either out to ask for instructions or to panhandle, particularly the way I'm dressed, no coat or tie, I walked around, trying to give the $10 bid away. The reactions were all within the experiences of the people. About three of them, seeing the $10 bill, spoke first, "I'm sorry. I don't have any change." Others hurried past saying, "I'm sorry, I don't have any money on me right now," as though I had been trying to get money from them instead of trying to give them money. One young woman flared up, almost screaming, "I'm not that kind of a girl, and if you don't get away from here, I'll call a cop." Another woman in her 30s snarled, "I don't come that cheap." There was one man who stopped and said, "What kind of a con game is this?" and then walked away. Most of the people responded with shock, confusion, and silence, and they quickened their pace and sort of walked around me. After approximately 14 people, I found myself back at the front entrance of the Biltmore Hotel, still holding my $10 bill. My four companions had, then, a clearer understanding of the concept, that people react strictly on the basis of their own experience. For another example of the same principle, here is a Christian civilization, where most people have gone to church, and have mouthed various Christian doctrines, and yet this is really not part of their experience, because they haven't lived it. Their church experience has been purely a ritualistic decoration. The New York Times some years ago reported the case of a man who converted to Catholicism at around the age of 40 and then, filled with the zeal of a convert, determined to emulate as far as possible the life of Saint Francis of Assisi. He withdrew his life's savings, about $2,300. He took this money out in $5 bills. Armed with his bundle of $5 bills, he went down to the poorest section of New York City, the Bowery. This was before the time of urban renewal, and every time a needy-looking man or woman passed by him, he would step up and say, "Please take this." Now, the difference between this situation and mine around the Biltmore Hotel, is that the panhandlers on the Bowery, would not find an offer of money, or of a bowl of soup outside their experience. At any rate, our friend attempting to live a Christian life and emulate Saint Francis of Assisi found, that he could do so for only 40 minutes, before being arrested by a Christian police officer, driven to Bellevue Hospital by a Christian ambulance doctor, and pronounced non-compos mentis by a Christian psychiatrist. Christianity is beyond the experience of a Christian professing but not practicing population. In mass organization, you can't go outside of people's actual experience. I've been asked, for example, why I never talk to a Catholic priest or a Protestant minister or a rabbi in terms of the Judeo-Christian ethic or the Ten Commandments or the Sermon on the Mount. I never talk in those terms. Instead, I approach them on the basis of their own self-interest, the welfare of their church, even its physical property. If I approach them in a moralistic way, it would be outside their experience, because Christianity and Judeo-Christianity are outside of the experience of organized religion. They would just listen to me, and very sympathetically tell me how noble I was. And the moment I walked out, they'd call their secretaries in and say, "If that screwball ever shows up again, tell him I'm out." Communication for persuasion, as in negotiation, is more than entering the area of another person's experience. It is getting a fix on his main value or goal, and holding your course on that target. You don't communicate with anyone purely on the rational facts or ethics of an issue. The episode between Moses and God, when the Jews had begun to worship the golden calf, one is revealing. Moses did not try to communicate with God in terms of mercy or justice. When God was angry, and wanted to destroy the Jews, he moved in on a top value and outmaneuvered God. It is only when the other party is concerned, or feels threatened, that he will listen in the arena of action, or threat or a crisis becomes almost a precondition to communication. A great organizer, like Moses, never loses his cool as a lesser man might have done when God said, "Go, get thee down, thy people, whom thou hast brought out of the land of Egypt hath sinned." At that point, if Moses had dropped his cool in any way, one would have expected him to reply, "Where do you get off with all that stuff about my people, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt? I was just taking a walk through the desert, and who started that bush burning, And who told me to get over to Egypt? And who told me to get those people out of slavery? And who pulled all the power plays? And all the plagues? And who split the Red Sea? And who put a pillar of clouds up in the sky? And now all of a sudden they become my people. But Moses kept his cool, and he knew that the most important center of his attack would have to be on what he judged to be God's prime value. As Moses read it, it was that God wanted to be number one. All through the Old Testament one bumps into "there shall be no other gods before me, thou shalt not worship false gods, I'm a jealous and vindictive God, thou shalt not use the Lord's name in vain." And so it goes, on and on, including the first part of the Ten Commandments. Knowing this, Moses took off on his attack. He began arguing and telling God to cool it. At this point, trying to figure out Moses' motivations, one would wonder whether it was because he was loyal to his own people, or felt sorry for them, or whether he just didn't want the job of breeding a whole new people, because after all he was pushing 120 and that's asking a lot. At any rate, he began to negotiate, saying, "Look, God, you're God. You're holding all the cards. Whatever you want to do you can do and nobody can stop you. But you know, God, you just can't scratch that deal you've got with these people. You remember the covenant in which you promised them, not only to take them out of slavery, but that they would practically inherit the earth. Yeah, I know, you're going to tell me that they broke their end of it all, so all bets are off. But it isn't that easy. You're in a spot. The news of this deal has leaked out all over the joint. The Egyptians, Philistines, Canaanites, everybody knows about it. But, as I said before, you're God. Go ahead and knock them off. What do you care if people are going to say, 'There goes God'? You can't believe anything he tells you. You can't make a deal with him. His word isn't even worth the stone it's written on. But after all, you're God and I suppose you can handle it." And the Lord was appeased from doing the evil which he had spoken against his people. Another maxim in effective communication is that people have to make their own decisions. It isn't just that Moses couldn't tell God what God should do, no organizer can tell a community either what to do. Much of the time, though, the organizer will have a pretty good idea of what the community should be doing, and he will want to suggest, maneuver, and persuade the community toward that action. He will not ever seem to tell the community what to do. Instead, he will use loaded questions. For example, in a meeting on tactics, where the organizer is convinced that tactic Z is the thing to do. "Organizer, what do you think we should do now?" Community leader: "No. I think we should do tactic X." Organizer: "What do you think, leader number 2? Leader number 2: "Yeah, that sounds pretty good to me." Organizer: "What else knit you, number 3? Leader number 3: "Well, I don't know. It sounds good but something worries me. What do you think, organizer?" Organizer: "The important thing is what you guys think. What's the something that worries you?" Leader number 3: "I don't know, it's something." Organizer: "I got a hunch that I don't know, but I remember yesterday you and number 1 talking and explaining to me something about somebody who once tried something like tactic X, and it left him wide open because of this, and that so it didn't work or something. Remember telling me about that, number 1. Leader number 1, who has been listening, and now knows tactic X won't work, sure. Sure. I remember. Yeah, well, we all know X won't work. Organizer: "Yeah. We also know that, unless we put out all the things that won't work, we'll never get to the one that will. Right?" Leader number 1, fervently: "Absolutely." And so the guided questioning goes on without anyone losing face or being left out of the decision making. Every weakness of every proposed tactic is probed by questions. Eventually someone suggests tactic Z, and, again through questions, its positive features emerge, and it is decided on. Is this manipulation? Certainly, just as a teacher manipulates, and no less, even a Socrates. As time goes on and education proceeds, the leadership becomes increasingly sophisticated. The organizer recedes from the local circle of decision makers. His response to questions about what he thinks becomes a non-directive counter-question. What do you think? His job becomes one of weaning the group away from any dependency upon him. Then his job is done. While the organizer proceeds on the basis of questions, the community leaders always regard his judgment above their own. They believe that he knows his job, he knows the right tactics, that's why he is their organizer. The organizer knows that, even if they feel that way consciously, if he starts issuing orders and explaining,